thing got to be. And I don't mind him switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the wheel of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the wheel of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country halls, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the wheel of life.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, with lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Lots of interesting things happening. Hope I can find this material that I found a bit earlier today, and it's very, very interesting. It's about the cost of illegals in the United States, and it really is quite significant. I don't think that is going to be easy to find out, to find. I'm going to check it out again here and see what we can come up with. I'll fly back to Toronto today from British Columbia, and once again I noticed the way the airlines just shamelessly abuse their passengers. Now, the issue is actually two issues in question. Number one, there was a you come around with the, see, you don't get any food on these flights. Well, you have to pay for that if you do, and the food's terrible. But you know, not even a little package of cookies or even pretzels. It is as cheap and mean as can be. Anyway, they do bring around tea and coffee and juice and water. So the service came around and they asked what I would like. I said, well, I'd like a cup of tea. Oh, we don't have any tea or coffee or water. Oh, why is that? Well, something's wrong with the equipment on the plane. I said, well, that's outrageous. I said, considering the amount we paid, and I was paying about $550 one way to fly from British Columbia to Toronto, considering the amount of money we're paying, that's just not acceptable. You know, when I bought the ticket, I didn't say, geez, I'm $15 short. Can you let me on anyway? No. I mean, you have to have the full price, or too bad, you don't get on the plane. Well, all right. Fair enough. The airline expects full fare. Why then, when they fail to deliver from their end, don't we get any compensation? Like nobody says, well, okay, here's a voucher for $25. So when you land, you can get some coffee, maybe even a little snack with our compliments. Oh, no. Huh, too bad, whatever. And I had some, the stewardess was almost rude to me. And she said, well, we could have canceled the flight. I thought, well, yes, you could also have gotten in another plane. And, these situations, in my judgment, don't just occur. You know, somehow, after landing and staying in Kelowna, British Columbia for half an hour, the plane suddenly developed problems with whatever heats the coffee and the tea. Or have this problem been going on for a day or longer? It just can't be fixed. Unacceptable. You see, passengers are used to being abused. And there aren't enough passengers like me who are prepared to push back and say, no. That doesn't cut it. That isn't going to cut it. I want some sort of compensation. Yeah. The girl won away from me. On these poverty flights, they don't even have they don't have an entertainment system on the more senior Air Canada airline. They do, and it's free. Well, that's nice. Okay, on Rouge, which is their poverty airline, you can rent a iPod. Of course, you have to have a credit card. You're lucky if you don't have any cash. And I heard the stewardess say to the, I was at the window seat. This girl I'm thinking of was on the aisle seat. There's one person in between. So I heard her say, or at least I thought I heard her say, only you have to give us a piece of photo ID, which we'll hold until the end of the flight when you return the iPod. I thought, did I hear this right? Well, there was an Englishman sitting one seat ahead of us, and he too had wanted to get the iPod, but he objected. He said, well, what do you mean, I have to give you a piece of my ID, like a passport or a driver's license? Oh, well, yes, it's policy. He said, I don't agree with the policy. That's precious documentation. Oh, well, he was brightly told by the first stewardess, that's just to make sure you return. And besides, there are so many people who will get these on the plane, it's hard to keep track of them. I thought, this is utter moronic nonsense. In fact, I later saw the stewardess had a clipboard, and she noted down who had rented an iPod and what seat they sat in, and so on. And near the end of the flight, it wasn't a matter of returning them on your honor. She went through the plane and went to each seat where somebody had rented an iPod, and I would think it might be 1 in 10 people did that, if that, and collected it. He said, well, are you saying that your passengers are dishonest? He said, well, wait a sec. You want my photo ID, and you'll go off to the back of the plane with this. How do I know you're not going to copy it, or some other stewardess is going to copy it, and steal my identity? Identity theft. We don't do that. And he said, wait a sec. You don't trust me, and I'm a paying passenger. I don't know you from Adam, and I'm going to hand over my photo ID to you? Well, I think there should be more people like that. You know, corporations, like government, are big bullies.
They will push as much as they can, and they'll try to get away with as much as they can, on the basis that, well, okay, not many people will complain. Or my guess is, very few people complain. They don't like it, but you know, there is absolutely there's absolutely no merit in being quiet, none at all, because being quiet they take for weakness or consent. Either way, they don't care. They are bullies, and that's what you have to understand. Many big corporations and certainly governments are bullies, and they will take you for as much as they can, and they'll abuse you. And you know, if you don't say anything, well, they will draw one of two conclusions: either you agree, or if you don't agree, you're too weak to do anything about it, so it doesn't matter. I was recounting this to a good friend and advisor to me earlier today, and she said, and I thought it was a very good point, one of the things that's going on is that there are so many people from the third world, and they come with different expectations. They're used to being pushed around. They don't have the same expectations that we do of privacy, and that we don't owe these corporations anything. They make a huge profit. Air Canada makes a lot of money by charging high fares, and not giving the average passenger very much, and that's why I get pretty insistent about this, that you have in the case of Air Canada, they have gotten a very good fare from me, and I don't like to be abused. They've gotten a very good fare from me, and I think it's up to them to deliver what they promised. At the very least, tea and coffee. Now, they have an excuse. Well, I don't know, something wrong with the machine or whatever. Okay. As that would not have gotten me on the plane if I said, you know, I'm $20 short. Then surely this shouldn't get them a free pass. You know, that we're supposed to say, things happen. Yeah, things happen. And we're supposed to put up with it? Well, I would say no. I'm not going to put up with it. We want compensation. And that could take a number of forms. If the plane were a little bit bigger, maybe this was possible, offer anybody who wants it a glass of wine or cup of beer, glass of beer. If that was not possible, why not a voucher that could be spent, let's say, just as a suggestion, at Tim Hortons, which is a common coffee and donut place that is located in almost every Canadian airport, as well as all throughout Canada. There are over 3,000 outlets. A voucher that could be used for to buy tea and coffee, maybe even a donut or something like that, and there would thereby be a recognition that the passenger is owed something,
you know, we're supposed to overlook the old stuff happens type of thing with the airline. But we're still expected to pony up the whole fare.
Well, I don't buy that. I don't buy that at all. I think we should be a lot more aggressive as passengers. Yeah, you know, my conclusion is big corporations and government will get away with whatever they think they can. And if you don't shove back, they'll get away with a lot. Because I think their attitude to people is a bad one. I hate to say that, but I think their attitude and their behavior is dreadful. I'm going to try to find something here. I'm having a lot of trouble tonight finding the items I wanted to talk about. But there's an extremely yes, I have a good idea where it is. A good one sent to me by my good friend Stan Hess down in the state of the state of Idaho. And Stan is a shrewd observer of the human scene. And let me see if I can find what he put out. It's actually quite funny. Stan sent out an interesting story about black crime. Oh yes, here we are. These are two relatively severely beaten young Negroes. One has a black eye, a number of bruises on his face. The other one seems to have a few bruises too. Joseph and Tyree robbed the wrong bar. A cop bar. They're not too bright, these young Negroes. Two bungling burglars raid a bar where a police retirement party is being thrown, and surprise, surprise, it didn't end well for them. Two armed men held up a Baltimore bar this past Tuesday where a group of Baltimore County police officers had gathered for a retirement party. Some of the off-duty officers attending the retirement party gave chase and arrested the two men nearby. Police charged Joseph McGinnis, the third, 21, and Tyree McCoy, 22, with armed robbery, theft, and related offenses. They came in mass and demanded cash from the register at the Woodlawn Bar at Monahan's in Woodlawn. The Monahan owner Jack Mulaney, said the man demanded cash from the register and then took off. An employee informed the officers that the robbery had just occurred, and a few of the officers attending the outing went outside and were able to chase down and arrest the suspects nearby. And this is actually across the street from a police station. During the shift changes, the bar owner said that there are a lot of squad cars coming and going into the station, and many of the officers are regular customers. It's kind of odd you'd even attempt it, Milani, he's the owner, said. Officers are always in here. There's a decent number of them. you can't cure stupid, can you? I'm going to use one of the part of my musical interlude right now for a song that is really just too good to be true and really fits this. This is the Volley Fuller 4, I Fought the Law and the Law Won, in honor of Joseph and Tyree. Apropos of the story we just read, dedicated to Joseph and Tyree, two Negroes, not very bright, these boys, robbed a policeman's bar, got chased and got arrested, and they certainly don't look they don't look to be any the better for wear, I'll tell you. Oh, this is Paul Brom, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. College graduate IQ in freefall. One of the weird, this is by a university professor. One of the weird things about higher education is how the smart people are just fleeing it. Now, that's at the graduate school level, and I noticed it seemed to start just about the time I was done with graduate school, this fellow writes. And my most talented friends were getting their PhDs, seeing what higher education had to offer, and deciding on an academic, an academic career was a terrible idea. They headed for the real world, never to do anything for education or research. It takes brilliance and character to conceive the 4 years spent getting a PhD was a waste, and I needed to do something different and walk away from all the hard work. I acknowledge my error here. Here's my anecdote. This is by a fellow who writes under the name Professor Doom. This is my anecdotal evidence regarding the really smart people, although he says I'm not alone in seeing this, but what are the rank and file college students? Here's what's been happening. A helpful chart answers the question. The graduated in the 1960s, a person used to have an IQ of about 112.3. In the 1970s, about 109.1. In the 1980s, about 106. In the 1990s, about 103. In the 2000s, about 102.9. And today, it's what used to be the white average, about 100. And he goes on to say it may only seem like a few points every decade, but in terms of statistics, there's much to be said about that chart. First, a minor digression. In the olden days, companies would give aptitude tests to people that they might possibly hire. This was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, as the company would invest considerable resources into training an employee. Thus, they were quite motivated to make sure the employee was apt, that is, able to learn the skills the company needed. No point trying to educate somebody who just, frankly, didn't have the brains. The government forced aptitude tests to disappear, but companies still wanted some way to tell if a person would be able to learn the work they were going to train them for. What to do? Well, the government generously allowed companies to restrict hiring to college graduates, that is, hiring to only people who had a government-granted certification of aptness, whatever that meant, that's like a, you know, a BA. Say, does anyone else see a conflict of interest in government forcing people to not use anything but government to determine something? Let's see how the law of unintended consequences works out here. And this is a man writing under the name of Professor Doom. I majored in computer science at college. I programmed every day. I went to graduate school for computer science. I programmed every day. My first job, I was a computer programmer at HBO. I was so bad that they had to send me to remedial school for 2 months to learn enough about computer programming to be as good as their worst programmer. Seriously. Thus it came to pass that having a college degree became a gateway into the middle class, unlike in the past where simple talent and skills were enough. The funny thing is, a college degree as it is today doesn't really help companies much, even if you have a very specific skills degree like computer programming. If a company hires you, you'll likely still have months of training in how to actually program in a way that the company will find useful. The collegiate version of programming focuses on computer languages and skills, which went obsolete a decade or more ago because it takes at least 10 years to set up a college degree program, and anyone who deals with computers knows a decade may as well be 1,000 years for computers. While I blame the student loan scam for the immense growth in the size of our campuses, the loans just pay for the degrees. The demand comes because many companies have no other way to restrict their hires beyond requiring a college degree, and the kids are told this for nearly every day in school. Now, let's look at the chart he's mentioned more carefully, by first considering the variation from each decade for the first 4 decades. So the variation, the fall in the average IQ from the 60s to the 70s was a fall of 3.2 points. From the 70s to the 80s, 3.1. From the 80s to the 90s, 2.1. From the 80s to the 2000s, 1. You can dispute the validity of intelligence tests in general, but you can't dispute the trend in the above. Certainly, you expect to see variation from decade to decade. When the variation is always in one direction, you must suspect that it's not random. It may look like there's a bit of convergence, namely that the drop is going to zero, but this is just how probability works. The proportion of people the proportion of people with IQ say between 109.1 and 112.2 is roughly the same as the proportion between 102.9 and 103.9, even if the latter is a smaller range of numbers. More simply said, in terms of proportion, every decade we lose about the same amount of intelligence in our college graduates. Okay, that still might not be simple enough, but the gist should be clear to the layman. College degree means less, means way less than it used to in terms of intelligence. And I'll come back to him in a moment, but Dr. James Sanchez in Seattle has frequently shared this concern with me that the IQ of the United States is relentlessly falling, largely because of mass third world, but mostly Hispanic immigration. And Hispanics have a lower IQ in general than do white North Americans. If the average white IQ is 100, the average IQ coming up from Mexico and Central America is 90 or below. That means that as these people become more and more numerous, they are a drag on the national IQ. And Professor Doom continues, now let's consider the most recent decade, that's the 2000s. When the drop of IQ is now 2.9. This is a relatively huge drop compared to the previous decades, about 4 times as much in terms of proportion. In short, we've gone from a disturbing but relatively constant drop in the IQ of our college graduates to a very sharp drop. Today, in terms of intelligence, a college graduate now is simply average. How useful is such a government certification? The price of the degree has gone up dramatically, while the usefulness of the degree to employers has dropped even more so, to effectively zero. You could just get a random guy off the street and expect average intelligence, after all. I'm saddened by the loss of our most intelligent people in graduate school. We're losing our best and brightest because they're smart enough to see quickly that higher education is a dying system that would merely exploit them. This does not bode well for humanity, as this will impact the advancement of human knowledge, which is where the West, particularly the United States and Germany and Britain, have shone for several hundred years. Alas, the issues are even bigger than what's happened in graduate school. To say we're well into the territory of diminishing returns is to understate the problem. We're past the point of negative returns. Most Americans in college today are not benefiting from being there. They're foregoing work to accrue debt for degrees that, if they increase earning power at all, do so only marginally, and they're picking up an unhelpful sense of entitlement in the process. While there is truth in the above, I'm more concerned by the suddenly accelerating drop in IQ, this is Professor Doom writing, in our college graduates in the last decade. At this pace, it's reasonable to conjecture that very soon a college graduate will have below average intelligence. It will be perfectly clear that the smart people aren't just leaving graduate school, but they'll be fleeing college in general. It's a big problem for humanity that our scholars will no longer represent the smartest people humanity has to offer. It's a bigger problem for humans that having a college degree will mean that you're of below average intelligence. Once again, we see the law of unintended consequences in action, as turning higher education into a government program to determine who is qualified to have a good job will instead undermine who is unqualified. That our kids are going to sacrifice for certification of incompetence is insult to the injury. And he argues, Professor Doom, to end the student loan scam. Provocative thoughts, I think, and I always think it's important to look at the damage done to IQ and to the falling IQ, largely as a result, though not only as a result, of promiscuous third world immigration, much of it less intelligent than average Americans. Now, when the numbers were relatively small, a country might get by with it. When the country is not, when the immigration is huge, as has been the case for the last four decades, the genetic damage is huge. I'll play another song here, and this is, inspirational by Merle Haggard, America First.
Freedom's stuck in reverse. Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and let's rebuild America first. Once more. Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it the most. Think I'm blowing smoke? Boys, it ain't no joke. I make 20 trips a year from coast to coast.
And that's Merle Haggard and America First. Great song. It could really be the theme song of the Trump revolution. Kind of play another tune, kind of along the same way with a girl, woman with attitude. Pretty much the way Merle had. Actually, he does a little bit of a cameo role on this, and this is Gretchen Wilson, and it's called
Fix Things We
Can't. Politically Uncorrect.
You're the low man on the totem pole, and I'm for the underdog, God bless his soul. And I'm for the guys still pulling third shift, and the single mom raising her kids. And I'm for the preachers who stay on their knees. And I'm for the sinner.
That's Gretchen Wilson with an assist from Merle Haggard, Politically Uncorrect. And this is Paul Fromm, and I'm Politically Uncorrect, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. This is a sad story, and it's been all over the internet. And I'm going to give it to you as I understand it. I believe Ursula Haverback, I met her, I know her. She's 88 years old, an incredibly courageous German mother, grandmother, writer, thinker. And she has problems with the Hollywood version of World War II. She is a Holocaust skeptic. She was sentenced to 10 months in jail because of that, and she went to the appeal court. The appeal court turned down her appeal and slapped her with a 2-year sentence. And now, this is a story that I have seen this before, but this was put out by Carolyn Yeager, who's quite well informed, and Carolyn Yeager has a great radio show called The Heretics Hour. I think the one thing that is perhaps missing from that is that she is not actually in jail. She is taking the appeal to the next level. The beautiful and courageous Ursula Haverback, now 88 years old, received an increased sentence of 2 years by the appeals court she applied to after her 10-month sentence from a Verdun, that's in Germany, district court last November. That's November of 2016. In the Verdun court, she was found guilty of Holocaust denial and incitement. On Monday, August the 29th, the appeals court found her guilty of 8 counts of, quote, inciting the German people to Holocaust denial. And this is, of course, the moronic understanding of communications. Just because Ursula says something, or I say something, or anybody says something, doesn't necessarily mean anybody who listens to this is incited to anything. It was as if she was punished for bothering the court with her appeal, and a warning given to others not to follow her example. I've had exactly the same situation with an appeals court in Canada. In a libel case that we were appealing, we were found, Cafe and myself were found guilty of libeling legal pet Richard Warman. I called him a censor, and according to Judge Metivier, that was libel. That was damaging his reputation. Anyway, won't get into that. Back to Ursula's report. Carolyn Yeager's report about Ursula Haverback. It's as if she was being punished for having even bothered the appeal court with her appeal. Yet we know that the Jews cost the German people millions upon millions of euros with their endless legal actions brought against elderly former SS members who happened to be assigned to work at a camp during World War II. It's also true that the German people don't get any news about Haverback's denial claims anyway, so it's not possible they could become incited by her. It's a news blackout in Germany on anything remotely revisionist. Even the internet is censored. As I understand it, her articles were only published in a local newspaper, Voices of the Reich, read by very few who are already sympathetic. I cannot even find any mention of this verdict in the German news, and only one story from the UK. It's a real case of internet censorship. The whole setup in Germany is a farce, acting as if Ursula Haverback is a genuine threat to the Constitution, a Constitution that was given to the Federal Republic of Germany by the Americans, not ever approved by a referendum of the German people. It was basically an Allied-imposed Constitution, which isn't much of a Constitution at all. Conditions in Germany are similar to George Orwell's novel 1984, where massive brainwashing is the order of the day. Jews are elevated to high positions of cultural authority from whence they make pronouncements of what is and isn't allowed. Germany, says Carolyn Yeager, is a very sick society today. Ursula Haverback is a brave voice for intellectual freedom who will not be silenced. That is her only crime. And it is really sad to think that Ursula is an 88-year-old grandmother. This must never be forgotten. We should remind people at every turn what's being done to one of our fellow thinkers in the West. Okay, there's a new book out, apparently by Jade Brooks. And she now makes her home in Calgary, even though she grew up in a Negro area of Halifax, Nova Scotia. And she's the author of The Teen Sex Trade, My Story. And at age 16, she became a whore. And she was farmed out to strip clubs and body rub joints by her pimp. Her so-called boyfriend. Now, you wouldn't at first know that she was black, but I'm going to go I'm going to go through an interview with her, I've got to say, really, there are some holes in this. Now, sir, her parents. Now, you're not told this at first. Her parents were. Her father was a serious. Her mother was a serious alcoholic. The father was in and out of jail, and the kids, when she was 11, were put into foster care. And the interviewer asked her, "Do you blame your parents for messing up your life?" "Although my parents played a role in creating the environment that put me into foster care and eventually led me to being vulnerable enough to be coerced into the sex trade." Now, it turns out, how was she coerced? She wasn't handcuffed in a slave. It turns out that she so wanted to please her boyfriend that she became a whore. Now, that would strike, I would think, any reasonable person as wrong. Now, she's imbibed all these psychobabble terms the psychobabble, it excuses her. Now, I'm not saying she wasn't pressured. She said she was vulnerable. Well, yeah, she may have been vulnerable, but she had a foster home. She chose to go with this boyfriend, whom she loved, or so she says. And then he started beating her, and then he put her out doing tricks. Well, now, she had to know that was wrong. She had to know being forced to sleep with other guys, not voluntarily, but being forced to as part of her, by her so-called boyfriend, was wrong. This is whatever else it might be. This is not love. You really have to ask yourself, what's wrong with the girl? She says she was vulnerable. Well, that's all the right psychobabble. Yes, she's vulnerable. Yes, she was probably impressionable. She was only 16. But come on. Growing up in a sexualized society, you've got to know that prostituting yourself for money that you don't even really get to keep, it seemed to be basically to support her lazy-ass boyfriend. Now, that's not love. And at some point, a person has to be responsible for their own life. She's using all the right psychobabble stuff. She says she was vulnerable. She doesn't really blame her parents. But it led me to being vulnerable enough to be coerced into the sex trade. These evasions, the sex trade, that's not like the needle trade, or the,
or the shoe repair trade. She's a whore. She's a prostitute. That's not really a trade. I understand the generational trauma and systemic barriers that cause someone to be unable to care for themselves in a healthy way. She's excusing her parents. I understand the generational trauma. What does that mean? That you have to grow up and maybe neither of her parents did. Her mother was a drunk and her father was a criminal. And systemic barriers. What barriers to being a decent human being? Anyway, so she's not really blaming her parents. And she's asked, well, how did you meet your boyfriend who pimped you out eventually? We were introduced to a mutual friend. At first it was great, but it changed when he began to verbally and emotionally abusive. Sometimes during the first year, she was only 16 at the time, the first time he hit me was with the phone. So thereafter, because he would leave marks on her face, he fell to choking her. It was a typical domestic abuse situation where you believe you're the reason this is happening. I went along with his plans because I loved him and was seeking the stability in life which he promised. Well, what sort of stability in life is it being put out as a whore?
Let's see, what else does she say?
Your friends and family were telling you he was bad news. Why didn't you listen? Well, good advice, even from a somewhat dysfunctional family. We broke up constantly, but we always came back together. I believe that by becoming involved with an exploitative person was inevitable based on my vulnerability. Just excusing yourself. Other people were telling her, be careful. I mean, it wasn't like he completely deceived her. He's bad news. He's using you. He's exploiting you. This can't be love of an individual when that individual is forcing you to sleep with complete strangers. But she says she was vulnerable and exploited. But she allowed it. At the same time, the onus is on him because he saw an opportunity to exploit me and he chose to take that opportunity. And he had a dumb enough bunny that she was prepared to be a whore for him. See, it's not her fault, according to her. At the same time, the onus is on him because he saw an opportunity to exploit me and he chose to take that opportunity. It wasn't my fault that I was vulnerable and lacking the awareness of where those vulnerabilities could lead. Well, wait a sec. You weren't brain dead, presumably. Others had told you he's using you. You had to know, or she had to know. This is Jade Brooke. She's a negress from Halifax. She's written a book about the biggest teenage prostitute. It's everybody else's fault but hers. She was vulnerable. She may have been persuadable, but she wasn't. She wasn't a complete moral moron. She was asked why she stayed with her boyfriend. She kept hoping things would get better. She says, "I thought that all the bad things that were happening was the sacrifice I had to make to keep this person in my life. I didn't leave because I was in love with him. I would have done anything for him, given my life if I had to. He was the only thing I had, really. As bad as that sounds to people on the outside, I wasn't that connected to my own family, and he was the most consistent person in my life, even though it wasn't remotely in a positive or healthy way." Well, he was a consistent person in her life, putting her out as a whore, and she's thinking somehow this has something to do with love. I'm sympathetic to the idea that she probably was exploited. He presumably was somewhat older than her. But I don't think
that lets him off, lets her off the hook. This plays into the extreme feminist agenda, where all men are bad. She was vulnerable. She may have been vulnerable. She may have been persuadable up to a point. But she had to know the difference between right and wrong, and being put out as a whore was wrong. And this wasn't, and she happened to know that. She wasn't happy about that. So she had to know that. Some people might say, well, you're a little hard-hearted. I'm not sympathetic to this. I'm not. She had to know that being put out as a prostitute, basically to support this guy, because apparently she felt if they earned money, he would be happy and they would be happy. That this is was not the the proper way to live. I suppose it's she's lucky, I guess. She's apparently left the world of prostitution. She's left Nova Scotia. She's now in Calgary, and she's got two young twins of her own, and she's going to try to be a good mother. And I say, well, more power to her. I hope she does. But I certainly am not prepared to buy the I was the vulnerable victim. She was vulnerable, yes, but she was also to some extent she was involved. She wasn't dragged by her hair and slammed down on the bed and forced to have sex with these guys. I think it's time to insist that people take some responsibility for their own lives. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All these are all Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.